supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Thanks for listening to Voices from the Family. When a child shows symptoms of mental illness, families begin on a long and difficult journey. It's hard to get a diagnosis since symptoms change as a child goes through different developmental stages. Parents have to coordinate their child's treatment plan and find the right schools. The stress on marriage and relationships with other children can be overwhelming. On today's show, we'll hear excerpts from a recent panel discussion on children and mental illness. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. We'll discuss diagnosis, therapy, and treatment for children with mental illness and find out what resources are available for families. We'll hear from a psychiatrist and an outreach coordinator, but first we were joined by Jim and Helen. They adopted two children, and one of their daughters was 3 years old when she came into their home. Within a few weeks, she began to exhibit signs of mental illness. Let's go to the beginning and what you first saw. It's pretty easy for a parent, even a new parent of an adoptive child, to know something's seriously wrong. Tell us what you were seeing. What was the first step you took?
When my daughter, she was three, threw my daughter's Rosemary's crib across the floor. She was in a fit of rage just to get dressed.
What did you do?
Well, we made sure the baby was safe and so I can handle Anna. We calmed her down, but it was still a fact that we had to call the doctor. And the pediatrician at the time said, oh, no, she's fine. She just needs attention because of she being adopted.
Next step.
Next step, we kept on fighting, and we took her to different hospitals, but we just got the constant she needed to be loved more.
That was pretty consistent from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were also saying that how can you diagnose a mental health issue in a child that young, and yet they were prescribing medications to her from age 4 and up.
So she was getting labeled.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Through the process.
She had labeled from post-traumatic stress to ADD to reattachment disorder to obsessive behavior disorder.
Asperger syndrome.
And many of these diagnoses came with their own medication?
Yes.
I would imagine?
Yes.
Did any of them help?
For a time being, it helped.
Tell me about therapies that you received, she received, back then.
She went to preschool for children with mental health issues. They play therapy with her.
How did you find these services? Were there supports around for you?
Well, a lot of it came from my older sister who was adopted. We got involved with the PIN Network, Parents Involved Network Association. Then I just took it from looking up in the internet to trying to talk to people who had, you know, who I think would be able to help.
What kind of people?
Parents, different doctors.
What was happening with you? I'd like you both to answer it individually. What was happening with you these first couple of years inside?
It was hard because she used to say different things, mean things, and, you know, and I always took it to offense. I still take it to offense now, but I learned that it's not me. It's the situation with her having the mental health issue and her being adopted. You know, she has a lot of anger in her that she needs to get out, and it seems like nobody can help her in getting the anger out of her.
I want to come back to those first few years, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
You said it was hard. I would imagine that's a pretty mild word for what it was really like.
Right.
Those first few years. Were you scared? Were you angry? Were you?
I was scared, and at the time we were really thinking, why do we adopt her?
Jim, were you angry at the agency, the adoption agency? Did you feel betrayed?
Yes, I felt they lied to us. I said at the time she was a revenge placement for other foster children we had in the household. And I went as far as to tell other agency workers that, and they were like, no, she wasn't. I was like, yes, she was. And the reason I say that is because she was 3+ when we got her. She'd been in foster care several times, and they didn't find their history on her parents till about 2-3 weeks after we had her and she was doing this. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, the father had these kind of issues, the mother had this kind of issues. They didn't tell us that before we got her.
How does all this affect your relationship with her? And I want to start with you, Helen.
Well, she never really had a mom, and she really doesn't know how to deal with the mom situation. She always takes it out on me when she goes through her fits of anger. I guess mother instincts that wants me to protect her all the time.
Do you feel motherly towards her?
Yes, I do.
Does she feel fragile to you?
Sometimes it's hard to say because when with her, when I she wants things, she can be very affectionately and, you know, want a mother. But other times she'll push me away with a drop of a hat and I'll say, you're not my mother to me. And she can be nasty and cruel sometimes to me.
Jim, tell us about your relationship with Anna Marie.
I want to say first, there are times when Helen has not worked outside the home. She was able to be home for the kids the whole time. She's had more exposure than I have. But at first, when I was coming home from work, I was like, oh, God, not again. You know, hearing about things, Anna did this, Anna did that. There are times over several years we were worried about Rosemary and sleeping at nighttime, what Anna might get up and do. Fortunately, she's never done that, but we worried about that ourselves.
Tell me what happened when she hit school age. What were the resources available to you? What weren't available? How did she change?
Well, she started in a preschool program, then she went over to the one in Media. She eventually ended up in Head Start, and then she went right into our school district. And our school district in her early years, from kindergarten on, were like, Aranda doesn't have problems. What are you talking about? And we had one good resource worker who I'll name, if that's okay, Howard Dubrow, who actually went to the school psychologist and said, you're not seeing this in first or second grade, but by third grade, you're going to see this behavior. And by third grade, they saw that behavior.
And when you say resource worker, where was he from? What agency?
He was child guidance, wasn't he?
Child guidance, yes.
I mean, we've had some good resource workers through that system.
What is a resource worker?
It was her therapist.
Wraparound
therapist. The wraparound people who came into my home.
Let's talk about that. You use language that needs some explanation. Wraparound services, case management. What is that?
That's different people who can help you get services for your daughter who's able to be there. The case managers is actually there for the parents who might need somebody to talk to. Wraparound services come with a behavior specialist.
And a mobile therapist.
A mobile therapist.
And the mobile therapist is a psychologist, if I recall correctly.
Yes.
Right.
And who provides those services?
Our insurance company provides it. Foundations.
So it sounds like you've had a lot of services for
us. Yes,
we did. So what works and what doesn't?
With Anna, it's hard to say. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. She needs people that's going to be directly on her and not let her slide by with any behaviors. We had people who were no good to people who were good. It's a matter of just being in fact of fighting all the time for what you want for your daughter or son.
And also how they work with the other people. We had a third grade teacher who she had that retired since then, but she was great with the wraparound people. She worked with them and things were coordinated.
Tell us, she's 13 now.
Yes.
Yes.
So bring us closer to what life is like now for you.
Well, right now, we kind of have, you could say, a little break because she is in residential placement. She tried to commit to kill herself.
For what, the third, fourth time?
Third or fourth time or so because she was requested to do her room or requested to do some chores in the house. And she's in a mood that she doesn't want to do them. We call these butt heads. She butts heads with me all the time. It's a constantly that I have to step back at the situation or it would be explosive. She has abused me by punching me, slapping me across the face.
Several times.
Kicking me, making bruises on my legs.
Several times.
So,
let me ask you again. How do you feel about this child?
I love her.
Jim, how do you feel about her?
I told her to her face, I said, you're giving us 10 years of hell. You come home this time. First time you raise a hand to anybody, we're calling the cops, and you're never coming home. we will never say it's safe for you to come home. And she understands that, I think, because there have been times she's been angry, she's had to hand back, and she's like, I can't do it, I'm going to get in trouble.
Well, you've told us what you're going to do when she comes home, but tell us how you feel about this child.
If she said she wanted to go to another home tomorrow and it could be worked out, I would not shed a tear.
How has this affected your marriage? You can't possibly agree on everything every time.
We don't,
but we respect each other.
And we try to not to confront each other in front of the our girls.
How has this changed you, or has it?
Well, I kind of grew up in a home where my father and brother always went at it. My brother might have been diagnosed with different things like ADHD and things like that. For years, I swore I'd never get married, never have kids, never wanted to go through that at all. Then I'm just going to say, for lack of better terminology, I grew up and figured I got to live my life. And I told Helen, actually, before we got into foster care, I never wanted to adopt a child like this. And honestly, had we known about Anna's issues before we got her, I probably would have been like, ex-nay, no.
You too, Helen?
I guess I'm a little bit different because my grown-up years were more, I guess, more a regular family type. It was always happy.
Did you ever get a diagnosis, or do you need one, want one?
For Anna? I would love to hear somebody who really doesn't know her to be able to look at her and see if they could find something else. A lot of people tell me all the time, you know, this kid is, somebody's missing something. And to this day, I still feel like somebody's missing something on her. Because she can be sweet, she has a kind heart, but when she turned the mean Anna, as I call her, you don't want to be around her.
Tell us your hopes, your fears for Anna, for you.
Well, I hope Anna can be able to handle her disorder. All she wants is people who love her.
My hope is that she can show how intelligent she is all the time. She's always tested at least 2 grades above her level, and she's always been cited as being very intelligent by anyone that's tested her, that's had her in school, teachers, things like that. So I would hope that she would show that. My fear is that she would go just the opposite way and constantly be a mental health issue or crisis in the home.
We're listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on children and mental illness today. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. Coming up, we'll be joined by psychiatrist Karen Winter Borgman and Catherine Panzarella from the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family.
The Penn Program for Stress Management supports WHYY and features a mindfulness and intimacy program for couples. Dr. Dan Gottlieb of WHYY's Voices in the Family and Dr. Michael Boehm, director of the Penn Program for Stress Management, encourage you to experience how mindfulness can enhance intimacy, caring, and connectedness. Details at 215-615-2774 or stress.management@upenn.edu.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on children and mental illness. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family discussion series. We just heard from a couple whose adopted daughter suffers from severe mental illness. Now we're joined by Karen Borgman-Winter and Catherine Panzarella. Borgman-Winter is a psychiatrist with the Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania. Panzarella is a psychologist and the director of the Family and Youth Support Advocacy Division of the Mental Health Association of Southeast Pennsylvania. What was it like for you listening just now?
It's heartbreaking for me every time. And I've come to work with families who are helping other families, because there is such power in the families like Jim and Helen who reach out and want other families to know how to get help, are willing to share their journey with other families, are willing to break down that isolation, share information, help each other out.
What was it like for you, Karen?
I think I was most struck by the impact on a family where a child has a psychiatric disorder or a mental illness that has, in a way, no end point. It goes on and on and on and on, and it wears people down and makes it really difficult to figure out what to do next.
Let's go back to the beginning of their story. A parent comes to you with a child who's expressing some kind of behavioral, emotional disturbance. They expect a diagnosis and a treatment plan. Sounds reasonable.
Sounds fair.
There's a but.
The but is, embedded in the story that we heard today, which is that it is difficult to make a diagnosis in children, oftentimes, not always, but sometimes. It can be particularly difficult in children who have complex stories, where multiple factors impact on the way the child is presenting. And we know not enough about what constitutes certain disorders in earlier stages. As a field in psychiatry, we have reasonably well-defined behavioral criteria for certain disorders. We can say this is bipolar disorder, or this is depression, or this is whatever. That is a little bit different in children because they're developing, their brains are developing over time, and the way that they present symptomatically is different at different times. And so it's not surprising, really, that people find it difficult to reach diagnostic certainty at different stages, and that diagnoses change even over time.
What do you look for when a child comes to your office?
When a family walks into my office, oftentimes I have no idea what brings them there. So my first question is, what brings you here? How can I help you? What are you looking for? And that's the family as a whole. I bring the whole family in and I ask them, what are you looking for? And try to get the picture from the family as a whole. It's, to see how they talk to each other about the questions on the table, and also to hear what each person wishes for. Then we talk separately so that I can understand each person's point of view. And then the child, of course, we do what's called a standard mental status examination. It has its own criteria. But the context is all important, as you hear from this family. If you don't have the context, you really don't know how to understand the child's behavior.
You specialize in psychotic disorders, arguably the most severe of the psychiatric disorders. What raises a red flag in your mind when you see a child? When we were preparing the show, you talked about a hypothetical child who might be withdrawn and irritable and doing poorly at school, maybe having tantrums at home. One mental health professional might send that child to psychotherapy. Another might say the child just needs more loved. Another might put the child on antidepressants or an ADD drug. What should be done for this child? Catherine?
I was going to say, one of the things we really work on is those are all possibilities, and they're all, I use the analogy a lot, of doors by which you enter a service system. And it really shouldn't matter which door you enter by. You should be able to start to make the connections in a service system that's working well. As long as you start on any path that's reasonable, you're looking, you're seeing if it's working, you should be led to the next possibility. Now, what happens in reality in our service system is, I think the President's New Freedom Commission uses the words fragmented, opaque, and a maze to describe the children's system. So really what they're describing is you go through a door in your room with no window, no way out. You're kind of stuck in one thing that's very compartmentalized and may not be working enough. When in reality, as you describe sort of how diagnosis emerges and how there's an emergence to treatment decisions, in reality, in a service system that works well, there should be a very smooth flow between these things. So you're moving from one thing to the next.
But.
But. we're not there.
Here it doesn't happen, and we have a system that's difficult to access, difficult to find the right services, difficult to get people to hear you, and, you know, we're not talking about a sprained ankle here. We're talking you know, people under tremendous stress at the bottom of a steep learning curve.
Right. And as Jim and Helen, I think, pointed out so well, unfortunately, our service system is also very oriented toward taking care of very acute or intense or dramatic situations. And the moment there's some improvement, services are pulled away, often creating actually more severe problems as you disrupt those attachments.
I want to come back to you, Karen, and you specialize in the brain. So as we learn more about our brain and our genealogy, we're learning probably the majority of mental illness and mental health is probably genetically based, yes?
People will argue that both ways, and appropriately so. There's impact of genetics, what we carry with us, as we think about adoption and you know what happens in those kinds of situations. At the same time, environment plays a role and has a potential for both good and for ill in any person's life, and that is true in mental health situations as well.
Tell us what we're learning about children's brains with mental illness?
Well, as I was saying earlier, one of the things we do understand is that children are not little adults. The brain is developing in a multitude of ways over time, and we're just beginning to have the opportunity to do the kinds of studies that we would like to even know what the developing brain looks like in children. These are kind of like, for example, imaging studies that would allow us to trace the development of a healthy brain. Because that's really the starting point as we try to understand what mental illness is or what deviant or different development is about. If we don't have a baseline, if we don't understand fully the normal trajectory, we don't know what to compare it to.
And a lot of our understanding of children's mental illness, a lot of the treatments we use are based on adults.
Precisely. So a lot of what we know about medication therapy is handed down from adults, and that's from the studies that have been in adults and what we know about what works in treatment in adults. The difficulty is that all that information hasn't been well developed in children, and not just children in general, but children at specific developmental stages. So we have the problem of diagnosis, and then we have the difficulty of matching up when we're talking about biological therapies or drug therapies, the drug to the developing brain and that diagnostic category. So it is very complicated, and it is a process that requires someone to be working with a family over time, because this is a process. This isn't a one-time kind of thing.
Once you have a picture of what's going on with the child, and diagnosis aside, once you know that this child has a pretty severe psychiatric disorder, not unlike Anna Marie, how do you tell the parents what's going on, and how do you tell them about the future?
I think one of the most important things is to be, there are many important things, but important to be both realistic and hopeful about the future. I mean, I think both things are important. So whatever we know about diagnosis, I try to offer what we know about diagnosis and what we know about prognosis or about predicting how things will turn out in the future. But we really, that's a very imperfect thing. And I think it would be unfair, really, for most families and most children to make a prediction as to how things are going to turn out. We actually don't know. So we talk about partnering for the very best outcome that we can possibly fashion for that child, and that it is a process. I think that is the most important thing. I wish that the system of care would support a process, as opposed to you come in for an evaluation, then you're out the door, and that it makes it very difficult to provide proper services.
From your eyes, we're going to talk to Catherine in a minute, but from your perspective, what would that process look like?
The process would provide a network of services that are easily accessible, and services that are provided by persons who are competent, and access to a trajectory of services that would provide, if it's inpatient that's needed, then that so that when someone leaves inpatient, they move down to systematic level of care that provides the supports that are needed but not prematurely terminated.
How long, if you know, a family has a child showing some disturbance, how long do they have to wait before they can get an appointment at Children's Hospital for a thorough workup?
I don't actually know. That changes over time, but I know that waiting lists can be extremely long in any system. Certainly months is not unheard of.
Especially for children.
Particularly for children. And we are an area, this region is rich with child psychiatrists and services compared to many areas of the country where there are virtually no service providers within any kind of range.
This business of advocacy, you know, traditionally we think mental illness is an illness.
Mm-hmm.
Just have to get treatment and it'll get better, or we just find another treatment. So what is the role of advocacy?
Well, at Mental Health Association, we really do two things. One is individual advocacy, which a lot of people don't think about when they talk about advocacy, but that, for instance, is Parents Involved Network that Jim and Helen mentioned, and that is parents who've had the experience of having a child with mental illness, helping other parents, sharing journeys, and helping them with information and get the right service. So our advocates not only support parents in a sharing of stories, which is a very, very important aspect, a peer-to-peer aspect, but they literally do things like go with parents to education meetings, individualized education plan or IEP meetings at schools. You know, support with the system the way it currently is, but at least trying to get those connections made and trying to get information to people and people helping each other. The other aspect is what I call systems advocacy, and that's probably more traditionally what people think of, but that's trying to really raise awareness about how the system needs to improve and really move along the vision. I mean, things are better than they used to be in many parts thanks to advocacy efforts. Particularly in the Philadelphia area, there are really some exciting efforts underway. With the recent Mayor's Blue Ribbon Commission on Children's Behavioral Health, which has now become a citywide compact.
What is that?
And that's been an effort for leaders in the child-serving systems, in government, to really try to improve the access and what's available and trying to get this full continuum of care available to children who need it.
I want to talk about economics here. Certainly people with fewer resources have fewer options. What does one do when they don't have the economic resources?
One of the things we really promote are sort of these peer interactions and these partnerships between peers and professionals. If you talk to families who are using services, they'll absolutely be able to tell you where higher quality services are for any particular problem. And families can make demands to get the services they want and be successful in that.
Make demands of who?
Make demands of the providers, of the insurers, the payers, school districts when it's appropriate, that kind of thing.
How does one make demands of an insurer? They're writing the check.
Families have rights to expect treatment to be effective, to expect to partner with providers to achieve effective treatment, and to be able to do things like file grievances if need be with, for instance, the insurer if treatment's not working.
In your experience, is that effective?
It's effective. It's not, you know, the fact that you have to go through a grievance process is a sign of a system that's not working really well. I don't think anybody would describe this as a pleasant process, but families who are aware of their rights to do that and exercise those rights do obtain more effective services than families who don't.
We do see patients and families who have gone through that process. So I can definitely say that people are successful in doing that, because I know that they say, this is how I got here, because I argued with my insurer, and this is where I was before, and this is where I am now.
Yeah, I don't think most people are aware of their option.
I just want to say that does actually happen, because I see those people.
This is exhausting, this process.
Yes,
it's
it is.
Exhausting raising a child, as we learned from Helen and Jim. It's exhausting finding resources. What kind of help is available? Is there anyone around who can physically help, who can make calls or file complaints or watch the child for maybe even a weekend?
Well, one of the things you're raising, again, is sort of having this full continuum of care. I mean, one of the things we're really advocating for at a systems level at this point is respite care. And there have been some recent successes in making that more available. And that's, for instance, you know, having a chance for the breaks, that kind of thing. The system funds a small amount of this individual advocacy that I talked about, people who actually help people make phone calls, go to grievance hearings with them, help them with the process and the paperwork. It's a drop in the bucket, and we could really use more of that.
We're listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on children and mental illness. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series. My guests were Karen Borgman-Winter and Catherine Panzarella. Borgman-Winter is a psychiatrist with the Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania. Panzarella is a psychologist and the director of the Family and Youth Support and Advocacy Division of the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. We'll hear more after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family.
Supporting WHYY Mainline School Night with over 500 day, evening, and Saturday courses from City Line to Paoli. Details at 610-687-0460 or online at mainlineschoolnight.org.
Supporting WHYY, the Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia, offering A Taste of Judaism. Are you curious? To anyone Jewish or not who would like to explore or re-explore the foundations of Jewish tradition. Taste will be offered this fall in 9 synagogues throughout the Greater Philadelphia area. Taste is open to the public. Registration is required. For details, 215-832-0597 or tasteofjudaism@comcast.net. A regular meeting of the WHYY Board of Directors is scheduled for Tuesday, September 18th at 8 a.m. at WHYY 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia. For more information, call Diane Chenault at 215-351-2063.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on children and mental illness. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family discussion series. My guests were Karen Borgman-Winter and Catherine Panzarella. Borgman-Winter is an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, and she works at Children's Hospital. Panzarella is a psychologist and the director of the Family and Youth Support and Advocacy Division of the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. Let's open it up for questions, comments, reactions to what you're hearing.
Yes, I'm having a hard time discerning true mental illness with just defiant behavior. We have a 15-year-old, similar situation, adopted at birth, and outburst rage, but it was all confined to the home. There was never problems at school. Hit eighth grade and was totally out of control with drugs, everything. Diagnosed 4 different things: oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder, 4 different medications, in and out of 5 different schools in the last 2 years. Lots of truancy. We've gone the route of juvenile delinquents. He's falling through the cracks. He's not a juvenile delinquent. I find that the medication doesn't make a difference. If he's doing what he wants, when he wants, life is good. So I'm really having, I guess my question is how do you come across what is behavior and personality versus true mental illness?
I think at this point in our understanding of mental illness, we still go by behaviors. Each diagnostic category is described in terms of behaviors. You're naming a number of diagnoses. Conduct disorder, that's a behavioral diagnosis. But in fact, something like bipolar disorder is also described in behavioral terms. We wish and we hope for, in the future, biological kinds of tests that we could say this is specific for bipolar disorder and it's something other than ADHD. But at this point, we don't have biological tests. We don't have a blood test to do, as you're pointing out. We don't have any way to really pin it down specifically. So mental health or mental illness actually encompasses behavioral disorders, and of which you're describing. So there really is no distinction, particularly except that we think that some of things are more biologically driven. But we might be surprised, actually, to find out that some of the things we call, say, something like conduct disorder actually also has a biological component that we just don't know yet. So I think it would be even premature to say that that is or isn't a mental disorder.
And when you get a label like that, oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder, is it helpful or can it sometimes interfere?
Well, I mean, I think parents can talk more to that because as a clinician, I'm not sure how helpful it is, that kind of a description. And I think from a parental point of view, I'm not sure as a parent I would find that helpful either, because it just describes what I already know, which is I'm having a lot of trouble with my child who's behaving in a way that is seriously problematic. The real question is, what can we do to help? Now it boils down to really figuring out what specifically is going on and trying to pick it apart very carefully. What are the behaviors? How can we respond to those behaviors? And there are many different ways to approach that therapeutically. It could take more intensive therapy. Then I don't know what kind of therapy is available to you personally, but in general, we really look for some kind of encompassing sets of therapeutic interventions that could be in a wraparound kind of, depending on the age of the child, could be a wraparound set of services. That could be, if a child is willing to engage in psychotherapy, some cognitive behavioral kinds of techniques that could be helpful. It could be that the parents are, they become the main deliverer of services and trained in how to reinforce behaviors and kind of start to shape behaviors by reinforcements. But all this is very, it requires very precise and long-term kinds of responses to the child. And I think it doesn't do justice to the fact that it's just a very complicated situation.
Other question in the front?
I think one of the things, the key thing, I think, is to get a good diagnosis. Get a second opinion. Get a third opinion. Be sure, okay? Try the medication. It doesn't work on everybody. And in my own case, too, self-knowledge. I came from the Catholic school system. These things just don't come up. They develop over a period of time. And with proper diagnosis, I think a lot of can be detected at an early age. And in the 60s, I have a sister, in my family who is very seriously mentally, ill. And she was the brightest of all. And then in her late teens, she developed mental illness. And we had a hard time accepting it. She was away at school, and she couldn't fit in too. So I think in the last 30 or 40 years, we've made tremendous progress. I mean, there's hope, and in mental imaging and the medications, and there is tremendous, but I also found in the quality of care. And fortunately, I have two good counselors who will accept a reduced.
That's always an option when you can find them. There are two things about this gentleman's story that trouble me. One is this push that we all have to do for advocacy to find out, to get the best evaluation, the right treatment, the clearest mind. It saddens me because in the ideal world, we don't want people to work that hard. We want people, when they have a problem with their child, to be able to go get care, we need advocacy terribly, but boy, it's sad that we do,
I think one thing bears comment that I haven't had a chance to say anything about up until now, which is that there's this tremendous loss involved in and a grief process that goes on in trying to work with a child who's not going in the sort of beautiful way that we expect our children to grow. And so not only are we trying to advocate, needing to put all that energy into advocacy, we're also trying to deal with, parents are trying to deal with the loss that's involved in having a child with a mental illness. I think that just needs to be noted because I think that gets lost in the whole process.
And one of the things we might have seen in Helen's tears earlier is that the grief process is not like regular grief when you lose a loved one. It goes on and on and on. It does need to be addressed. parents and families need advocacy, and they need care badly.
They do need care. And I guess the other thing, parents need support, too, just for themselves, not just for their child, right. But they need it for themselves as well. I think that's just one of the key pieces in you know, when I look at families and try to help.
Another question?
I have two questions. Earlier you stated about wraparound services and that the insurance companies pay for the services. My first question would be, is this a long-term service or short-term service? If so, what is the time frame? My second question is, I would like to hear your opinion on inclusion.
As far as wraparound goes, I'm not sure if I can give you the real specifics that you're looking for, but what I can say about wraparound is this was something that was designed to be fill principles of delivering services that are family focused, child centered, community based, that would be very, very individualized, you know, where you might have, you know, much more intensive set of services at particular times or for particular problems, and much less so if that's what was needed. That was the ideal design of wraparound. The reality in terms of its delivery through our service system is that it's become something that's, you know, more high-end, you might say. It's been basically prescribed for more severe problems in what you call, I guess, sort of higher amounts in packages that aren't really individualized the way wraparound was originally intended to be, but to have these, you know, typical components of mobile therapists, and I think Jim and Helen called it a resource coordinator. They use slightly different names, but, just kind of a support person for the therapy. So in reality, the service that really was supposed to bring a full continuum is something that does tend to get pulled away as soon as problems get somewhat better. And the design of the service is really one, it uses a lot of behavioral principles of treatment, and it's really one that is likely to be most effective when you are starting to get some improvement in terms of really solidifying and maintaining that with some real skills building. So it's really been implemented in a way that I think quite sadly really minimizes its chance to be effective and also minimizes its availability. Again, our individual advocates help a lot with that kind of thing. Sometimes it can be effective through the grievance process. And then at a systems level, it's really about the service system really looking for maintaining skills, for being able to adopt a little bit more of a prevention or early intervention mindset to problems rather than just being so crisis-oriented.
Another question?
Hi, my name is Diane Shea, and I'm a psychologist who recently accepted a position in Elwyn, which is a residential program for children with mental illnesses. And I'm very new to the system, and I wasn't familiar with Philadelphia's system. But the biggest frustration that I have come across is residents are placed in residential treatment facilities in a neighborhood where, in fact, they really have very, very, very serious emotional problems and need a higher level of care. And everyone from the psychiatrist to the psychologist to the unit directors to the executive director knows they need a higher level of care, but there are no beds. And so I don't know if you've come across that, but you know, the waiting list for getting a resident in the appropriate level of care where they may need a locked facility with an on-ground school, the waiting list could be 3 months, 4 months. And in the meantime, it's very, very difficult. The hospitals won't accept involuntary commitments. There are no beds. So I just see it's such a systematic failure for these residents, and I don't know what to do about it. I'm too new. Insight you can give me, I'll take.
This touches every level here. The beds aren't available. Therapies not available. Even evaluations could take months to happen, and when they do, if you're lucky, you get a mental health professional that can spend the time. It sounds like at every level the system's broken, top to bottom. Mm-hmm. You can find corners where it's working. What needs to be done? I mean, do we need to start all over again?
Well, the President's New Freedom Commission called for no less than a system transformation. I mean, they, you know, the system's been called absolutely broken, needs to be, you know, not tinkered with, but rebuilt. There's no substitute for getting the right appropriate services at the right time. Services will never be effective if it's just here's what's available. So even if you have more acuity or less acuity, that's what you get anyway. Will not be effective that way.
You know, the word prevention and early intervention was mentioned here. So many of our decisions are based on economics. And when I say ours, I mean managed care and CEOs and politicians and every level. But nobody really realizes how economically viable it would be to invest in our children at younger ages and invest a great deal in our children at younger ages at every level. It would save us a fortune down the pike. But how do we make this shift? What does the President's Commission recommend? I mean, well, you know, the VA hospital in Washington, they just said, knock it down, start all over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's basically what's talked about. And it is really hard to make the shift. We see it all the time. For instance, in Philadelphia, we see all the time families in the crisis center who are there because of these long outpatient waiting lists, who keep the numbers presented at the crisis center very high. So what do? Cut back on crisis services and not have crisis services available? Yet, so many who come there, very often they're on outpatient waiting lists. Had they been able to get, you know, that right intervention when they first needed help at the right time, they wouldn't be there. At some point, it really is economics. You really do have to shift the incentives in the system.
Any other questions?
I think earlier in the show it was mentioned that the mental illness could be hereditary or it could be somewhat environmental. What do we know about how this impacts the healthy kids in our families? I have three children that appear to be perfectly fine, but the last 18 months have been pretty stressful at the least in our house. And there have been periods of that over the years prior to that, and I'm kind of concerned about what we should be doing for those kids to avoid problems in the future.
It's a great question.
That is a great question. I think that one thing that you're pointing out without realizing it is that you need to be paying attention to the needs of all the children in the house because everybody has needs. Certainly, this is not unique to mental illness either. If you have a child who's ill in any way, that impacts on the whole family and on each child differently, depending on where they are and what their needs are in the family. But it's and of course, as parents, you're stretched because you're trying to take care of a child who has greater needs than normal. But those children need attention as well. And I think the very first level is paying attention to that fact that that's, you know, in your favor as parents, if you can at least see that there are needs all the way around. But it is hard, and children are impacted undoubtedly by illness of a parent or a sibling or a grandparent or anyone significant in the household. And children are also resilient. That's the other important thing to remember, that what might seem catastrophic may not be. Children have amazing resilience in many cases. So there's no specific formula, but it's important to pay attention to the needs of each child, but not to be terrified that everything's going to fall apart with the next child just because one is ill.
With any disability in the family, often siblings feel as though they've become invisible, as though they've lost a voice. What they need, you know, it's everything Karen said. You know, they need time, they need attention, they need to feel as though their voice is being heard. However, I read a piece of research. If I had a memory, I'd cite it for you. But many older siblings of younger sibs with disabilities tend to emerge being more resilient than average kids, more involved in the larger culture. They tend to come out of the family with a bigger picture of the world, their role in the world, and their potential impact on the larger world. So the news isn't necessarily all bad.
There's also a program called Sib Shops that you might want to check out, with, which is specifically for siblings of kids with serious emotional difficulties.
Another question in the back?
I have a question and also a comment. The question is whether folks on the panel or in the audience have information about resources, in particular that pertain to adoptive children and adoptive families of adoptive children?
There are a number of resources. What I can tell you is that our advocates work with foster parents, natural parents, and parents of adoptive children. And again, there's a number of very specific resources. I can't cite them to you right here, right now, but again, if you call our line 215-751-1800-KID, we have advocates who can help you with that.
You could repeat that number for us?
Sure. 215-751-1800-513-KID.
You have a website?
www.pinofpa.org. Pinofpa.
I'd also like to, while we're offering resources, also suggest the website of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. There are a wide variety of parent and kid-friendly pieces of information about psychiatric disorders, about medication, about finding a psychiatrist, and possibly about adoptive issues as well. I can't say that specifically, but I direct you there as a good place to start in looking for resources.
You've been listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion about children and mental illness. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. My guests were Karen Borgman-Winter and Catherine Panzarella. Borgman-Winter is a psychiatrist with the Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania. Panzarella is a psychologist and the director of the Family and Youth Support and Advocacy Division of the Mental Health Association of Southeastern Pennsylvania. The program was made possible in part by the Devereux Foundation, online at devereux.org. Well, if you've got a question, show idea, or comment, email us at voices@whyy.org. You can listen to archive editions of Voices in the Family at whyy.org/voices. Thanks to Susan Palinko and Jennifer Wheeler from WHYY's Children's Service. The engineers for today's show have been Joyce Lieberman and John Knapp. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Our intern is Shane Ewing. Our associate producer is Elisa Walters. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.